Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You can tell that COVID-19 is over if you hadn't heard, because even President Joe Biden, Creepshow Joe, is talking about what? Particularly after the results in New York City, the initial results, at least, New York City mayor's race. I'm talking about violent crime, with violent crime up double digits in metropolitan area after metropolitan area across the country. Biden yesterday announcing how the federal government is going to help fight violent crime on America's streets. And really focused in on Second Amendment rights and offering a bit of a constitutional treatise, if you will.
We need to keep building on the gun violence and crime prevention strategy we're laying out today. Folks, this shouldn't be a red or blue issue. It's an American issue. We're not changing the Constitution. We're enforcing it, being reasonable. We're taking on the bad actors doing bad and dangerous things in our communities and to our country. Talk to most responsible gun owners and hunters. They'll tell you there's no possible justification for having 100 rounds in a magazine of a gun. Like I've said before, what do you think? The deer wearing Kevlar vest? Responsible gun owners will tell you that there are too many people today who are able to buy a gun but shouldn't be able to buy a gun. And these kinds of reasonable reforms have overwhelming support from American people, including gun owners.
Mm-hmm. Why do you need a high-powered weapon? Deer don't wear a Kevlar vest because your Second Amendment right is just about hunting. And before you go, no, it's not. It's about defending yourself against your government. He's got that argument covered, too.
The Second Amendment, from the day it was passed, limited the type of people who could own a gun and what type of weapon you could own. You couldn't buy a cannon. Those who say the blood of the blood of patriots, you know, and all the stuff about how we're going to have to move against the government.
Well said, Thomas Jefferson.
Well, the tree of liberty is not water with the blood of patriots. What's happened is that there are never been, if you wanted to think you need to have weapons to take on the government, you need F-15s and maybe some nuclear weapons. The point is that there's always been the ability to limit, rationally limit, the type of weapon that can be owned and who can own it.
Mm-hmm. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. For all of his suggestion that this isn't a red or blue issue, this isn't a constitutional issue, he sure talked about people's Second Amendment rights a lot, even as the initiative is mainly sort of a redux of Operation Legend from the Trump administration, combined with giving law enforcement wider berth, particularly ATF, especially with that Chipman that he nominated to be the head of it, you know, to go after and to otherwise make more difficult the exercise of people's individual Second Amendment rights.
And here's his plan: to crack down on gun dealers who break the law. Well, no, duh. And redirect billions of COVID funds to police and community intervention programs. And I thought of you. I'm like, Dan, midnight basketball.
Finally. More midnight basketball.
But yeah, good luck getting police officers, especially in towns like Chicago and New York. Homicides up 13.5%, LA 22%, Houston 24%. But yeah, good luck. Throw money at the problem, because that normally always fixes the problem.
If you willfully sell a gun to someone who's prohibited from possessing it, if you willfully fail to run a background check, if you willfully falsify a record, we'll find you and seek your license to sell guns. Well, I know that's already the law.
Exactly, those laws already exist.
No, but I'm really gonna enforce the law. Really?
And then Biden brought up Chicago.
Another study found that a program that offers high school students in Chicago a good summer job and an adult mentor and behavioral therapy led to a 45% drop in violence.
What? Wow. We have a 45% drop in violence? That's breaking news.
Well, he's talking about among this cohort that apparently attended whatever generic program he's referencing. I'd like to see the details on that.
Here's a former group ceasefire.
If it's Operation Ceasefire, that's false. I can tell you out of hand, that's false. But regardless, you have to make a case. You don't just get, this is what Biden, you don't just get to make sort of generic appeals to, there's a program I heard about that had some success. And so I'm going to throw $50 billion or $50 million or $50 billion at it. It's ridiculous. The Biden play here, though, is just about demagoguing the issue. To the extent that federal law enforcement backs the play of state and local law enforcement with some resources to combat street gangs, fine. Great. Leveling up street gang criminals for federal prosecution, fine. Great. Again, that's what Barr was doing in the Trump administration with Operation Legend. But what this really is demagoguing the gun issue and the gun rights issue for his base. And oh, by the way, speaking of his base, explain to me something. I need a nuclear weapon and an F-15 or two to take on the federal government.
And don't forget the cannon.
But a couple of hundred yokels who stormed the Capitol with flags and MAGA hats almost toppled that same government? Unarmed, effectively? So which is it? We had an insurrection and our very democracy was threatened. These Trump supporters almost overthrew the federal government. And then Joe Biden yesterday, what are you talking about? Defending yourself against your government. You need nuclear weapons and F-15. So which is it?
The group he was referencing is Cure Violence Chicago, which is former ceasefire leader. That runs it.
Fascinating, and I still want the details.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy talking about Joe Biden's pronouncements on guns and crime yesterday against the backdrop of the results of that New York City mayor's race, the initial results, and the increasing skittishness of Democrat socialists about the midterm elections as crime, violent crime in particular, continues to spiral in metropolitan areas around the country. Time to focus on crime. Time to tamp down that defund the police talk.
Yeah.
That was nowhere to be heard. In point of fact, Joe Biden said, cities and states can use some of that COVID relief money to hire more law enforcement officers if they can find anybody who wants the job.
Nobody wants to do the job.
One out of the nation's 20th largest local law enforcement agents, city and county leaders want funding increases for 9 of the 12 departments where next year's budgets have already been proposed. So now the ideology of your defund the police Democrat socialist runs headlong into the reality of what's happening on America's streets. And guess what? Now they're focused on their political viability. And so defund the police, push to the side. As Dan Henninger wrote in the Wall Street Journal, New York City voted, it was about crime. We've run the experiment across America. Progressive governance is an oxymoron. Their politicians do not know how to govern. Their ideas in our era exist in an over-the-rainbow dream world with no relation to the pedestrian realities of governing, much less protecting life. And guess what? You can play all the word games that you want. At the end of the day, people in places like Chicago and New York understand what's happening in their neighborhoods and their city centers.
Yeah, they don't feel safe. And if you look at it in totality, 32 states are seeing a rise in homicides and assaults. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Jason in Northlake.
I was going to get back to the point of Biden and those others that always try to say about the, you know, the concept of overthrowing the government. And I'll just bring up a point that when the Constitution was written and the line "shall not be infringed upon" was put into the Second Amendment, these were literally written by the same people that overthrew an oppressive government. So it's pretty clear to anybody that has half a functioning brain that the concept of the Second Amendment is about defending yourself from the government, not about hunting, not about sportsmen. It was about literally, like, we need to have the ability for the people to rise up against an oppressive government. And as far as, you know, F-15s or any of that nonsense, is that you got to think about what was the technology available at the time. And there's no dialing back as far as whatever future technology comes up. It's pretty clear, shall not be infringed upon means defend yourself against an oppressive government, which they literally overthrew. So they knew that at the time that they wrote it, and there's just no denying it.
Thanks, Jason. Mike, Northside.
Hey, good morning. A lot better topic than yesterday at this time. Two suburbanites talking about golf and dental dance.
Well,
Dan Proft and Saran Wrap Jacobs.
We're showing our range. And that was not us. That was the New York City Public Health Department.
So. Right. It's an actual thing, Mike. And I actually learned something yesterday, so pipe down over there, all right?
I hope you could put that in a good use sometime.
Yes.
Thank you. But I wanted to talk about crime. Why is Biden so concerned with giving more police powers for the police to go after law-abiding citizens, but, you know, they're emasculating when it comes to criminals? Doesn't seem to make sense. And, you know, I heard that they're having a problem at the White House. You know, even though he got rid of the dogs 2 months ago, somebody keeps wetting the floors.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, and there was no mention, too, of the other aspect of the criminal justice system. There's no mention of defunding the police, mention of funding the police,
right?
And no mention of the prosecution of violent criminals.
Because it's not working in Democratic-led cities, and people are waking up to this.
John in Portage Park.
Hi. Somebody should inform Joe Obama that, you know, the Taliban should be informed that you can't take on a F-35 with an AK-47. And also the North Vietnamese 55 years ago, they did pretty good with just rifles and hand grenades against a superpower with nuclear weapons.
Indeed.
That's all I had to say.
All right. Thanks, John. Yeah. And by the way, expectation is that Afghan will fall to the Taliban within 6 months of our departure. That was out yesterday. One intelligence estimate. Interesting. Bill and Glen Ellen.
Yeah, 95% of gun crime in this country is the direct result of the Democrat Party and its policies. If you go to any of the cities that have been controlled by the Democrats for decades, there's a revolving door for violent repeat gun offenders known to the police, known to the prosecutors, and if we could just stop the Democrats from releasing these guys over and over and over again, no matter how many times they're caught with illegal guns, no matter how many times they use those illegal guns for other crimes and actual murder, then we could reduce our gun crime by like 95%. And I think instead of fighting piecemeal over assault weapons and magazine bans, we need to go straight at them and say, look, you are the problem. Your policies are releasing these violent offenders, and you can look at Cook County. You've got guys on ankle monitors shooting people in the street. You've got, you know, guys caught multiple times with illegal guns with long criminal history who are plea bargained down on their gun charges, who are released on no cash bail, who then go out and shoot rivals at, you know, the holiday parties, you know, in their neighborhoods. If we just focused on telling people, stop the Democrat Party, it's them, not guns, I think it would change the whole dynamic of the gun control argument, and it would put the Democrats back on their heels whenever they bring up these stupid new gun laws, which all they want to do is take guns away. They don't care about the criminals with guns. They don't care that people are being murdered. They just don't. There is some mental defect in their brains. They have a phobia about guns, and it's a it's probably a control issue, too. They don't like people, you know.
Oh, and thanks for the call.
Focus on Democrats.
Thanks for the call, Bill. I think it's a good point in terms of focusing on Democrats and tying these cultures to their political leaders, because they're in control and have been in control of these cities in most cases for generations, as we've often talked about. And it's interesting, the other thing that Biden did yesterday, I referenced it with his comments about if you falsify a record, if you fail to do a background check, we're going to come after you. Yeah, okay. So he's focused on gun license holders, right? Federal firearm license holders. The gun dealers are the problem, because we can't ascribe agency to mostly black and brown young men in major cities, the perpetrators of most of the crime, as well as the victims of most of the crime. But we can't ascribe agency to them, so we have to go after license holders. Yeah, of course, the federal firearm license holders have to abide the law, and if they don't, that they should be prosecuted. But there's no conversation, there's no suggestion as to what Bill was saying and what we know all too well in Cook County about the attitude that Kim Fox takes with respect to repeat violent offenders. And this is the same in Philly, in San Francisco, in New York City, all across the country, where you have Soros-financed non-prosecution prosecutors. No question about it. And so the body count continues to pile up, and then you have a lot of innocent people caught in the crossfire. Remember, to the other point that was made about knowing who these guys are. Yeah, remember Eddie Johnson's basically saying, there's about 2,000 people in the city who I know are going to kill or be killed. We know who they are. But, I mean, we're not in Minority Report. We can't do pre-crime. We can't arrest somebody before they've committed a crime.
Or before they get murdered.
But we know who they are. And yet, once they are apprehended, as anticipated, they're turned right back out or put on an ankle monitor, which is essentially turned right back out by the de Blasios and Lightfoots, because the mayors are responsible, too, and the prosecutors that they're allied with. I mean, it's really that simple. But that is a key point, what Biden did. The nuclear weapons and the F-15s is what everybody's going to talk about. Focusing on gun dealers, lawful gun dealers, as the problem. Hey, hey, this is a message to you gun dealers, but not prosecutors and not families in urban centers, particularly in urban centers that are racked with violent crime. Very telling. Mike in Yorkville.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, most of your callers, they made excellent points, but the major issue that they're missing, this is all by design. This is nothing to do with, you know, them have a mental defect. This is by design by these people that have character flaws, understanding of what this country is about. But their agenda is to break down this society and to remove our rights. And that's what you have to understand. If you find yourself in a blue state or a blue county, it's either A, you leave because you're outnumbered, and you hold the line in some of these red counties or red states and don't allow the same policies creep over into those areas you want to live.
Thanks, Mike. Tony on the South Side.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. How are you? It's
good.
Been a while.
Yeah. Hey, Tony.
So, yeah. So, yeah, we don't refer to Tangerine Jesus. Now he's Tangerine Curios. So I believe John the Gospel didn't use Curios until he was crucified. So, anywho. Anyway, hey, so anytime I talk to somebody about the Second Amendment, I always want to, two words, Red Dawn. Think about Red Dawn, right? If those kids didn't have the Second Amendment rights, when the Soviet and Nicaraguan and Cuban troops fell out of the sky into that football field in Colorado, we would have been doomed, right?
Right.
And I mean,
not a documentary, but yes.
No, but you got the likes of Jed, Robert, Erica, Tony, Aardvark, my favorite, right? Everybody loves Aardvark. Those kids, without those weapons, those kids, this country would have been doomed. That's all I need to say.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Wolverines, Tony. Yes. Thank you. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Great movie.
Before Jennifer Gray got her
Dan and Amy. The one thing that I took away from Biden's speech is it sounds like the Democratic cities like Chicago and Baltimore, he says, that have strong gun laws. Now they want to go after the surrounding states because their laws aren't as strong. And those are the people that we have to go for. That's why there's so much crime. And as far as the assault rifles that hold 100 rounds that he says people don't need to go hunting, isn't it the handguns that are really killing all of these people?
It's the people with handguns.
When do we hear that somebody uses an assault rifle?
Yeah, right.
It's usually the handguns.
Yes, no question. Yes, exactly. Thanks for the call, Rich. And that was pointed out in that case in California. We talked about where that San Diego federal district court judge, you know, gave the data on, you know, more people stabbed, more people beaten than with these rifles that the left likes to demagogue. And also to Rich's point, too, right, that's the fallback position here. The idea of blame other states, blame somebody else far away, particularly if they don't share our politics. So who's the bete noire of Chicago? Indiana. All you Hoosiers trafficking guns into the gangbangers in Chicago. Not our fault. Blame the Hoosiers.
And people still kill with knives. I mean, don't forget that 31-year-old doctoral candidate from Maryland who was visiting, walking down the street in broad daylight on Saturday and was stabbed in the back by a homeless guy.
Marvin in Burlington.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask your opinion, Dan, of KT McFarland's comment yesterday concerning the overplaying of the liberal hand and all this crime. And, you know, they sort of let the tiger out of the cage, and their people are running wild, torquing on ambulances, picking up people in the street from being innocent people being shot. I mean, all this is due to their policies and her assumption or her prediction that they've all sort of that there's going to be a comeuppance and this is all going to go away, for a generation. And the other thing about this gun violence, I see all these people, they're law-abiding gun owners, aren't they? The people committing this gun crime. I mean, it's and they're going after the FFL guys.
Right.
It's just not good. But really, I was wondering your take on. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. So I agree with KT that there's going to be a comeuppance in 2022, and it's going to be at the federal level. It's not going to be in these cities. I don't see a comeuppance in most of these cities. I mean, if you want to call electing Eric Adams in New York City, if his victory holds, his lead holds, turns into victory, if you want to call that a comeuppance, okay, maybe a little bit. But I don't see real culture change in these big cities. Remember, what you're seeing on the streets of Chicago, for example, who's the major audience and who's the major audience that Lori Lightfoot and all the city elders are concerned about? You think they're concerned about families on the west and south sides? No. Suburban audience. The national and international tourists, that's who they're concerned about. They're concerned about where their money comes from. They're not concerned about who is being victimized by their policies. So that and that's where the comeuppance will come, because that suburban audience around the country that surrounds, you know, major metropolitan areas, they're going to, in those swing districts, they're going to make a different choice. And that's how Republicans take back the House and probably the Senate, in my view, as we stand here today. But I'm not as optimistic as KT. I think the comeuppance short term, yes. Will it be a real paradigm shift? I think that's an open question. And I think it's difficult to get a paradigm shift until and unless there is a culture change in places like Chicago. And when that comeuppance visits, I have no idea.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Text from 630. Be wary of Eric Adams, New York City. He ran commercials in support of CRT ideology early on before pivoting. Oh, I have no delusions about Eric Adams, New York City. I'm just saying former police, less of a Marxist hack than his chief opponents, who in the final debate couldn't decide whether or not they would allow police to carry guns. Okay.
Right.
Those are the choices.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Are we looking at Beirut on the Lake Part 2, the 2021 edition? Remember, Beirut on the Lake was 1980s under Harold Washington, the city council wars between the mayor and the likes of Edward Doleac. Do we have another Beirut on the Lake brewing, another edition of city council wars between Triple Threat and, well, you got your alderman Ray Lopez, and now you got your alderman Jeanette Taylor from the 20th Ward. She replaced Willie Cochran, who was sent on a federal vacation.
Oh, that's right, another one of those. Yeah, Jeanette, they were trying to call a vote for Cecilia Meza to be the next corporate counsel, and two aldermen jumped up and said, no, no, no.
When do we stop playing the game of mistreating people in our community? So this ain't about that. And so I second Alderman Lopez.
And what they were angered that the law department's moved to dismiss the lawsuit filed by Anjanette Young.
Right. That's victim of that wrongful Chicago police raid that we discussed on this show. It was covered by CBS News. And then Lightfoot, after this video came to light, this body cam footage came to light, you know, she got out there, did the mea culpa pro forma, and then talked about getting with Miss Young and trying to work out a settlement. I think $1 million has subsequently been offered. But
they offered and she didn't take it.
But emails from the city indicate that the Corp Council moved to have the suit dismissed initially before it became a subject of public conversation. And so this has riled Alderman Young.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Alderman Taylor.
Alderman Taylor and Lopez and Mayor Lightfoot. Well, she got out from her big desk and approached Jeanette.
I have considered your appeal, and I've denied it. We're going to Alderman Harris.
And then she took Jeanette Taylor to the cloakroom, well, back of the chambers, and they've had a heated conversation where fingers are being pointed in people's faces. This is what Alderman Taylor had to say about it after the fact.
I'm like, lower your voice and get your finger out of my face. And so she did get her finger out. You see me doing this. And so I'm holding my skirt. I'm saying, get your finger down. She got her finger out of my face, but she kept screaming at me.
Hmm. And Jeanette she described the woman who's they were pointing fingers at her and Mayor Lightfoot. What really happened there?
Just basically, I cut out a Latinx woman. I cut out a woman of color, DP in this. No, I didn't. This is to teach you a lesson about you have to work with us.
I don't know. Maybe not as colorful as Mel and Verdoliak versus Harold Washington, but it's getting there. And Lori Lightfoot doesn't have the jovial disposition of Harold Washington to sell her side of the story to the public, I would argue. On the John Cass, he used to be at the Chicago Tribune. Oh, do you remember him? Yeah.
Yeah, we had him on for an hour the other day. That guy?
JohnCassNews.com. He is still writing, so you want to follow him at JohnCassNews.com. The unbearable lightness of Lightfoot. She has lost the city. She lost it when she failed to stop that second wave of downtown mass looting last summer. She continues to lose what's left of it. Rather than maintain order, she undermines it. And the city council, by the way, no better. Remember, they spent most of yesterday arguing the finer points of Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable Lakeshore Drive.
And they never got to take a vote on it because Lightfoot canceled the city council meeting.
Mm-hmm. So
she lost control. So when you lose control, you cancel.
This is, you know, this is a Hobson's choice, triple threat of the city council. But going back to Cass, she's a corporate lawyer, not a wartime consigliere. But she wanted this job. This is her city. Do something, mayor. Well, she has done something, and Cass recalled what she did. And remember, this was a John Cass who was inclined to be supportive and hopeful, much more so than myself, of Lightfoot when she won. Cass writes, to boost her politics with anti-police progressives, she demonized the Chicago Police Department that she needs to keep order. She's overworked the cops and woefully understaffed the department. The CPD has gone for years without a contract and now exhausted and at the breaking point, and it's not yet July. She plays games with statistics suggesting violent crime is going down when it's on the increase. She shifts detectives to street patrol downtown, strips the neighborhoods of cops, puts empty squad cars along Michigan Avenue, and won't let police engage in foot chases. Tourists might be confused, but criminals are not, nor are residents.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I mean, I've got a family member moving here, and she's like, well, what's a safe neighborhood? And I said, I mean, you can't live in the Loop. You can't live. There's just neighborhood after neighborhood where I do not want her to live as a single woman.
No, I mean, I don't think you can say unequivocally that there's a safe neighborhood. There's no particular enclave. Obviously, there are neighborhoods that are much safer than other neighborhoods. But this, when you lose the city and you lose control, then you send the message to that small group of people in the city who are predators that this is your city, then they take it.
CWB Chicago, you know, if you don't follow them on Twitter, you should. They've got their finger on what's happening. They always put dispatch calls. Dispatcher. Caller says their family is afraid to leave Rock Bottom Restaurant and walk back to the hotel. They want police. And then this Good Samaritan, Ryan Blackburn, he said, yes, it's a family of five females, preteens to elderly. They were attacked on the way to dinner in broad daylight, and they're inside Rock Bottom waiting for over an hour for police. I decided to walk them to their hotel. You think tourists are going to come to Chicago in broad daylight when you feel unsafe to walk from your hotel to a restaurant? It is so sick what's happening. And now criminals are scaling the Chicago bridges to get in restaurants on the riverfront and take whatever they want. Police sent a warning out to the burglars are literally crawling down the side of the Chicago River Bridge structure to burglarize.
When you turn the city over to predators, violent or otherwise, these, you know, non-violent, non-prosecution crimes like stealing stuff. That's a non-prosecution, non-violent crime.
Well, it starts there, though.
When you turn the city over to them, to people who are interested in criminal conduct, then they take it. That's what they do. They take stuff, other people's stuff. And that doesn't include your private possessions. That also includes the city. So that's what's happening. And it doesn't have to be the likelihood. I mean, talk about psyche here again, like we talk about COVID. The likelihood of you being victimized in a violent crime doesn't have to be substantial. The perception is what drives people's understanding of the city and their desire to be here. And the perception is being of Chicago is being radiated out across the globe that this is an unsafe place. And it's not rat-tat-tat Al Capone when people are saying Chicago is unsafe these days. So that's a real problem.
How many of your family members have asked you, why do you still live in Chicago?
Well, here's
isn't it dangerous? Aren't you scared?
Yeah, here's the thing. I'm not really afraid, but I'm afraid that I would have to do something that I don't want to do. But I was talking to a guy yesterday. He lives in the suburbs, but he's got a condo downtown. I said, do you ever use the condo downtown? No. Well, yeah, we go downtown during the days, but we don't stay at night.
Wasn't that point?
Well, you know, right. You buy a condo downtown or you move downtown, sort of. Yeah, I mean, you can enjoy a park or two, but they have those in the suburbs. You sort of move downtown or have a place downtown because of the nightlife.
Yeah.
That's sort of the handle, isn't it? The restaurants and the bars and the entertainment
shopping.
Venues and the shopping and all that. Right. So now when you're saying, oh, yeah, no, I enjoy the city, but I only go there. As soon as dusk, you know, we bolt back to Lyle. That is not exactly an endorsement of Chicago.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Something else, too, since Alderman Taylor there was just, you know, regretted. She also said that there was this public spectacle of two black women. Oh, because everybody has to be in solidarity based on their identity, they have to be in solidarity based on their identity rather than on the substance of their position. Oh, you know, Alderman Taylor is just another hack, too, another trained seal in the city council. Don't let this little spat fool you. So the Alderman Taylors and the triple threats and all the identitarians and all the other assorted Marxists who've come in and out of the city council over the last 30 years. What have they wrought? How's it going? So much focus on combating structural racism. Is that right? Well, a study released this week by the University of Cal Berkeley's Othering and Belonging Institute.
That sounds like
found that 81% of the regions with more than 200,000 residents were more segregated in 2019 than they were in 1990. 81% of the regions with more than 200,000 residents, almost all of which are lorded over by Democrat socialists, the identitarians, those who have been fighting for racial justice for the last 30 years and have only amped it up, at least rhetorically, in the last 5 to 10. 81% UC Berkeley Institute found more segregated today, 2019, than 30 years ago, 1990. Well, isn't that fascinating? And they specifically cite Rust Belt cities. Rust Belt cities of the Midwest and Mid-Atlantic disproportionately make up the top 10 most segregated cities list. Detroit, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, Trenton, Chicago.
Democrat, Democrat, Democrat.
Uh-huh. Only out of 113 largest cities examined, only Colorado Springs and Port St. Lucie, Florida, qualify as integrated under the standard of these researchers. And why does that matter, integration? Well, one, just intellectually, philosophically, I thought that was the point. That was the point of rolling back Jim Crow. And not to mention all the raft of other laws that have been passed, fair housing laws and this and that. I thought that was the point. I thought the point was integration so that we get beyond race. We get to that content of character place. We get to that equality of opportunity space. Black children raised in integrated neighborhoods earn $1,000 more as adults per year and $4,000 more when raised in white neighborhoods than those raised in highly segregated communities of colors. This is the finding of UC Berkeley researchers. Does that matter? Show me the money, opportunity, equality of outcomes, you know, equity, as you say. How about that? Latino children raised in integrated neighborhoods earn $844 more per year as adults and $5,000 more per year when raised in white neighborhoods than those raised in highly segregated communities of color. Household incomes and home values in white neighborhoods are nearly twice as high in those in segregated communities of color. Home ownership is 77% in highly segregated white neighborhoods, 59% in well-integrated neighborhoods, but just 46% in highly segregated communities of color. 83% of neighborhoods that were given poor ratings in the 1930s by a federal mortgage policy were, as of 2010, 80 years later, highly segregated communities of color. And, oh, by the way, where are the lowest levels of segregation?
Where? Uh-oh, what?
Oh, boy.
What?
I don't know how to break it to you.
Well, I'm sitting down.
Southern states have lower overall levels of segregation than the enlightened, progressive Rust Belt segregated cities in big blue states. Southern states do, where Jim Crow existed. I guess they were more serious about it. I guess we had it all figured out or something. What is it? Are you going to tell me that this is the legacy of slavery here in Chicago? Is that it? Reparations? Trot out that sawhorse? Is that what you're going to do? Well, how do you explain the differentials? Boy, this study's a big problem, isn't it? It should be. I mean, unless that's what you're going for. So which is it? Maybe put this to, when instead of arguing about Lakeshore Drive's name, maybe put this to your alder being and your state legislative being and your mayoral and gubernatorial beings. more segregated today than 30 years ago. Worst offenders, big blue cities, big blue states. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Amy and Dan. With regards to neighborhoods and good areas of the city, let me bring up my old neighborhood, Edison Park, and also Wildwood. There's a few others, too.
Let me recommend, while I've got
Saugonash.
You.
Saugonash.
No, I'm still in Edison Park. Let me recommend Elliott Steakhouse in Edison Park.
Or Zia's.
Well, go
to Zia's, get a martini, then go to Elliott's.
Just stop at Zia's to get a drink and give Amy's kids some money, and then go across to Elliott's and get a... No, Zia's is good, too, but Elliott's Steakhouse. Good.
Oh, I've never... Okay, I'll try that out.
Yes.
Where's Elliott's? Because I go through there constantly, because my sister still lives in the neighborhood.
Right across the street from Zia's.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought there was a... Okay.
All right, enough of the restaurant guy, yes. Edison Park. Go ahead, Bob.
So, and Wildwood, Saugonash, and Forest Glen, I think, is still a safe and good neighborhood. The grade schools are still good, but unfortunately, my alma mater still, I think, got issues. That's Taft. I just saw an article in the paper about that they want to have police. In the school. They voted to keep the police in the school.
A lot of schools did. The LSC voted, yes.
You know, it was filmed at Taft, though, don't you? Bob.
Greece.
I was asking Bob.
Bob knows. Bob
I know everything about Greece because I was there right afterwards.
Who did you play in the high school adaptation of Greece, Bob?
Probably the nerdy character. What was his name?
You built the set because you're the structural engineer. Bob.
Yeah,
engineer. Come on. You're stagehand.
People don't realize the play, there really were the Pink Ladies.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They were an existing, in fact, your aunt, your aunt.
Aunt Linda went to Taft, yep.
Yeah, she went, I don't know if she was a Pink Lady, but they were really were the Pink Ladies. And, you know, Amy and Dan, did you ever see the original play?
No, I did not, Bob. And that's enough grease talk for one morning. Thanks for the call. Bye. Appreciate it. It's enough Edison Park lore. That's all I can handle. I tried to be nice, and then you had to take it too far. Matt in Waxhaw, North Carolina.
Good morning, Dan and Amy.
Morning.
Hey, you made a very prescient point. I told my kids for years growing up in Geneva, Illinois, that the South was much more integrated than the North. I grew up in Fort Wayne, south side of Fort Wayne, all black, north side, all white. Same thing with Chicago. My oldest son is in Buckhead, Midtown, Atlanta now, and he said, I can't believe it's really great to see the number of African-Americans that are making a great living, you know, mid to high income. My other son's in Birmingham, says the same thing. And I got to tell you, the South is much more integrated than the North. Not that it's completely absolved of any issues.
No,
but
of course.
There's less prejudice down here than I've ever seen growing up in the North, especially Fort Wayne and suburban Chicago.
Thanks for the call, Matt.
I have to look up Wax.
Congratulations to the Waxhaw? On the move. Waxhaw, North Carolina.
I'm Googling it now.
Carolinas are nice.
Everything's nicer. It's true. You go south of I-80.
It's true.
I mean, to start.
Yeah.
People are nicer. People are mean here. God.
Yeah.
It's like that COVID meanness. I don't know what it is. You can say hi now.
No.
You're not going to get the vid if I say hi to you. You can say hi back.
They just care so much about us here. Just so committed to saving lives. Steve in Downers Grove.
Don't say hi. You'll spread the vid.
Hey, Steve.
Yeah. Good morning. Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, the northern cities, they're really, especially the inner cities, they're just modern-day plantations. They have all the same characteristics. Mm. No hope. There's no way you can get out. You're stuck on there for your life. Lots of violence. They're slaves of the democratic machine. And transferred plantations from the south to the northern north, and they're just stuck. Plus, you know, everybody talks about life expectancy of African Americans. What happens if we took out the black-on-black violence rate, which is 9 times higher than white-on-white crime? If we eliminated that, what would that do to their life expectancy?
You know, she said that's third. That's third on the list. There's five reasons why. And,
Obviously it would narrow the gap. Obviously it would narrow the gap. Thanks for the call, Steve. We got to go. But it would narrow the gap, but it wouldn't eliminate the 30-year differential between residents of Inglewood and residents of Streeterville. It would narrow it. It wouldn't eliminate it.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and that audit of the Maricopa County vote tally from last November scheduled to be completed this Saturday. So we will see what comes of that. 2.1 million ballots forensically audited, and this is perhaps, we'll see, but providing an example to legislators in other states who've pilgrimaged down to Maricopa County to see how it works. Arizona-style audit, a very real possibility in Pennsylvania. We've talked about it in North Carolina. You still have action in Georgia, too. There is petition before a judge to unseal 147,000 absentee ballots in Fulton County and allow the petitioners to inspect them under certain restrictions. The judge is expected to rule on that motion in the near term. And then, of course, you have the effort by Democrat socialists at the federal level to federalize all the elections that has stalled because the likes of Joe Manchin are not on board. For a review of where we stand, getting a little bit below that surface review, and where this is going, pleased to be joined again by an expert in the field. He is Hans von Spakovsky, Senior Legal Fellow for the Heritage Foundation, former FEC Commissioner, and former lawyer for the Department of Justice. Hans, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on. And you gave a pretty good summary of what's been going on. You know, the biggest thing, as you said, is folks wanting to do audit. And what's amazing to me is the opposition to it from Democrats and liberals in general. You know, audits are routine in the business world, and they ought to be routine in the election world. Of course, the whole point of them is to find out, did all the voting equipment function the way it was supposed to? Were all the rules and laws followed? And it's like, why wouldn't you want to do that?
Well, but what they don't want is an examination of the ballots, number one, that forensic audit. Number two, you know, maybe there is some concern, which I think you're intimating, that there may be some irregularities that turn up. For example, one theory that is bouncing around out there, you may find that now that ballots have been ascribed to actual human beings, in other words, election authorities in the states have identified for their voter file who actually voted. Well, if you go to, say, Milwaukee and you have, okay, here's all the people who voted with a little check, they voted in that general election, and that adds up to X, and the total ballots cast in Milwaukee adds up to X plus another number, then you have some splaining to do, for example.
Right. Although, let me tell you, a good example of what the audits could actually find, you know, we're speculating here because they haven't been completed in Maricopa, but look, an audit that has gotten no media attention, and I think that's deliberate, is an audit just completed in Windham, New Hampshire, of last year's election. Now, they were looking at a small local election, but they discovered that the computer scanners that they used to read and count their absentee ballot was misreading those ballots. They discovered a problem with their computer scanner. As a result of that misreading of ballot, the winning candidate was not credited last year with 300 votes that they should have gotten, and they discovered that the losing candidate, who had only lost by about two dozen votes, had actually lost by over 100 votes. If they hadn't done that audit, they wouldn't realize there's a problem with their equipment. They now know about it. They can fix it before the next election and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Well, then what's happening here in Illinois? Because Governor Pritzker recently signed into law an election package. And can you explain what that is?
Yeah, I actually wanted to shake my head and laugh when I saw his quote about how this was a great package, that Illinois has this wonderful system. The election system in Illinois, particularly the voter registration system, is probably one of the most poorly run in the country.
Just to
give you a quick example. We maintain a database at the Heritage Foundation of proven cases of fraud, and there's case after case after case in there of non-citizens who, when they went to the Department of Homeland Security to try to change their status, in other words, some of them, for example, wanted to apply to become citizens, had to admit that they were registered and voting in Illinois. And Illinois officials had no idea that that was going on. But that tells you how bad the system is. And yet, what did the governor do? They've now switched to, for example, allowing permanent absentee ballot lists. So you could request an absentee ballot, and you'll be permanently on a list. And from now on, you won't have to request it. It'll just be sent to you every election. And, of course, if you're not able to maintain your voter list, which Illinois does a very poor job of, and you don't take people off who have died or moved out of state or who are not U.S. citizens, it means that every election, ballots are going to be sent to locations where, for example, that voter no longer lives. Well, who is it potentially going to get their hands on that ballot and then potentially submit it anyway, pretending to be that voter? Well, Illinois is making that kind of fraud even easier to commit, and they have almost nothing in place to detect any kind of problems like that.
It's not a particular surprise to anybody listening that Illinois is the worst in the nation at doing something, or near the worst in the nation at doing something. I've long proposed sort of flying off of the previous custom of state legislatures electing U.S. senators, that our current state legislature should actually just appoint all of the elected officials, including themselves in Illinois. So we just don't do elections here anymore. It's just so much simpler, you know, and cleaner. And then we don't have to worry about the voters, obviously. We don't have to worry about the machinations. We could keep everybody employed, associated with elections employed, because obviously the public sector payroll is the most important thing here. But that's a cleaner way to do it for Illinois. But for most of the rest of the country that's interested in having free and fair elections, we're not really that concerned about it here. But for most of the rest of the country, what say you about Joe Manchin's so-called compromise? I thought it was risible that he got opposition to his proposed at least 15 consecutive days of early voting from the Democrat Secretary of State in New Hampshire, speaking of New Hampshire, Bill Gardner, who reminded Manchin that the state constitution in New Hampshire requires that a voter must be present on election day unless absent from the town or city or physically disabled. And New Hampshire has the third highest voter turnout in the country for has had the third highest voter turnout in the country for each of the last four presidential elections. So now you have a Democrat Secretary of State telling Joe Manchin and the rest of the nation, hey, back off. We know what we do. We know how to run elections here in live free or die land. And we don't want to change the way we do it because you have a grand national scheme you want to impose.
Right, and we should mention Bill Gardner, who the Secretary of State of New Hampshire, is the longest-serving Secretary of State in the history of the United States. So I think he knows what he's talking about. Listen, the American voter won a big victory on Tuesday night in the U.S. Senate when Republicans successfully filibustered and stopped S-1, the big bill that they had that would have basically taken over the running of elections by the federal government and would have put in all these terrible requirements. You just mentioned one of them that would have endangered the integrity of the election process. I mean, another quick example of that is, look, New Hampshire is smart. They've got a voter ID requirement for voting. S1, if it had passed, would have outlawed any state voter ID requirement anywhere in the country. Now, what reason to do that when the American people overwhelmingly support that and think it's a common sense requirement? Well, it's just to make it easier to cheat.
Going back to Maricopa County, and, you know, so the part of this is the rules surrounding the administration elections, and then it's those charged with implementing. Ken Bennett, who is a Senate liaison to Maricopa County, to the audit, said auditors were informed by county election workers that the signature verification standards for mail-in ballots were at first lowered and then disregarded completely in November. We've literally been told, as Bennett is quoted as saying, we've literally been told people who worked in that process for Maricopa County that the standard at the beginning was quite reasonable and high. It was actually a 20-point ballot signature verification standard. But they got so far behind, we've been told, that they went to people on the team and they said, okay, reduce it to 10 points. And then to 5, and then 1. And then we were told, and I can hardly believe that this might have been the case, but it needs to be verified. We were finally told that those workers were told, let everything go through, including blank signature boxes. And he said, if that happened, which they're investigating, it's a terrible failure. But that's the other thing, is that the system gets overwhelmed, and then all of a sudden all the standards are out the window, which is why ballot security programs, and this is the responsibility of political parties as well, at the national as well as state and local level, this is why those ballot security programs are so important, to make sure that those election workers maintain the standards. And so somebody says, oh, we're being overwhelmed, we're falling behind, so we're just going to discard the standards. And a lawyer's there to say, no, you're not. We'll take as much time as is needed to do it right.
Yeah, and that, look, that might have changed the outcome of the election. You know, Maricopa County is the biggest county in the state. What they were basically saying was they gave a green light to anyone who wanted to commit absentee ballot fraud and send in ballot that they for other voters. Like, I don't know if you saw this, but a guy was just arrested in, I think it was Ohio, because he submitted an absentee ballot on behalf of his father, who was dead, forging the signature. And the only reason he was caught, according to the news story, is because an election official noted, didn't think the signature matched the signature of the dead father on file. So if you're not doing signature matching the way apparently they weren't doing in Arizona, that would never have been caught. Now, how much fraud like that occurred, we don't know. But an audit is one way to try to find that out. Well, again, if misbehavior occurred, wouldn't we want to know about it?
It is interesting as well that because of Manchin's recalcitrance on what has been proposed by the left, all of a sudden you got senators like Ralph Warnock saying, oh, yeah, I got no problem with voter ID.
And Stacey Abrams, too. And, you know, that is, Stacey Abrams actually came out and said that she had never been against voter ID.
No,
of course not.
Absolute, that is an absolute lie. She is on record having raged against voter ID. And it just shows how two-faced she is. Now, this is the same person who did everything she could to try to get Major League Baseball to boycott Georgia and move their game because of the election reform bill that Georgia passed. And then when it happened, and all these local business owners, many of them African Americans, complained to her about the loss of business, she suddenly said, I didn't want them to boycott the state.
She's a hot mess. But I mean, when you think about it, you have to show an ID to get a COVID vaccine, to get on a plane, to, you know, everything, right. You know, the list, but it's ridiculous to fight that.
So, Hans, how do you respond? You know, I had this chat the other day with a guy. Oh, yeah, you know, you're a Trump supporter. You voted for Trump. So you probably think the election was stolen, you know, the guy says to me sarcastically. And so that's sort of an iteration. That's just that guy repeating what you hear on TV all the time, where none of these enlightened news readers will tolerate any talk that they would consider part of the big lie. How do you respond to that sort of sarcasm and the big lie characterization of just not making any claim, but just asking legitimate questions or suggesting, as we have been talking here, about what is the problem with either a process audit or a forensic audit of some of these places where there were clearly irregularities or legitimate questions that could unearth irregularities?
what I would say to that is that they apparently think that we have a absolutely perfect election system in this country where mistakes are never made, and that's laughable. I mean, no, I don't think anybody could seriously say that that's correct. And don't you want to make sure that any problems that might have occurred won't happen in future elections, so that your vote isn't potentially stolen or somehow not counted because of anything from problems with voting equipment, like they found in Windham, New Hampshire, to other things? I'm not quite sure how to get around that, other than to say to them that they clearly aren't interested in making sure that every voter, no matter whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, every voter's ballot is counted.
He is Hans von Spakovsky, senior legal fellow for the Heritage Foundation, former FEC commissioner, as well as former lawyer for the DOJ. Hans, thanks for joining us, as always.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We talked about it this week with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano. We talked about it yesterday with former Deputy National Security Advisor K.T. McFarland, talking about the politicization of the U.S. military, folding in with the leftist ideologues when it comes to identitarian politics. Jim Carafano saying, and this is a big statement for him to make, not a statement he enjoyed making either, that the senior leadership of the United States military is the weakest, certainly in his lifetime, maybe in history. He described it as completely unprepared to operate on the political landscape that exists in America. Completely unprepared. And he must have been talking, he didn't say him by name, but he must have been talking, because this is a good example, not just of the recent Biden appointees, like General Austin at Department of Defense, but also General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He must have been talking about him, because how could you not, after the answer he gave during a House hearing yesterday on exactly that, the politicization of the military, pushing particular literature and discussions, and really not discussions, pushing a particular point of view on things like, here we are again, critical race theory.
Yeah, and a class that the cadets at West Point had to watch called Understanding Whiteness and White Rage. Here's the question from Representative Waltz, Republican from Florida.
The seminar that over 100 cadets attended, titled Understanding Whiteness and White Rage, taught by a woman who described the Republican Party platform as a platform of white supremacy. This is going on at West Point as we speak to our future military leaders.
And Congressman Waltz had a picture of them meeting at the seminar. And here's America's top general's response.
I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university. And it is important that we train and we understand. And I want to understand white rage. And I'm white. And I want to understand it. So what is it that caused thousands of people to assault this building and try to overturn the Constitution of the United States of America? What caused that? I want to find that out.
Were they trying to overturn the Constitution? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And then, you know, what he expanded on that answer.
I've read Mao Zedong. I've read Karl Marx. I've read Lenin. That doesn't make me a communist. So what is wrong with understanding, having some situational understanding about the country for which we are here to defend? And I personally find it offensive that we are accusing the United States military, our general officers, our commissioned, non-commissioned officers, of being, quote, woke or something else, because we're studying some theories that are out there.
Mm-hmm. Here's what I find offensive, General Milley. Your sophistry. That's what I find offensive. First of all, if you're in the business of being morally indignant over accusations directed at the military, how about that it's a legacy of white supremacy? How about that it is systemically racist like every other institution in America, according to your friends who are suggesting that any characterization of the military as falling in with leftist ideologues is offensive to you? Your concern about the accusations, does it run in both directions? You're so well-read. Oh, you've read Mao and you've read Marx and so on and so forth. That's not the issue. And you know it's not the issue. Yeah, I've read Mao and Marx and Trotsky and a whole panoply of intellects in economics and philosophy and history with whom I disagree. That's not the issue, and you know it. It is not a question of too much reading, too much exposure to intellects, even pseudo-intellects. It's a question of too little. That's the problem with critical race theory as it is being indoctrinated from pre-K through post-secondary, and you know it, General Milley. Now, I disagree with people moving to ban critical race theory because I think it's difficult to do that. You know, we start banning things. Well, what about this and what about that? It should be confronted straight away. But it's not conservatives like me who have a problem when General Austin at Department of Defense can't make his way around to answering a simple question, is the United States systemically racist? Is U.S. military systemically racist? Who are running around promoting the idea that the greatest threat to America's security is a handful of knucklehead white supremacists or a few hundred people who broke the law and did wrong on January 6th, but came nowhere close to overthrowing our Constitution. Get a grip, General.
Well, General Milley said yesterday that he believes race was connected to the unrest that took place.
Yeah, that,
and that's why they need critical race theory in the military.
And this is why he's a sophist. This is why he's a pseudo-intellect.
Our enemies are laughing.
The question is not, can I read Ibram Kendi and still survive? Of course I can. I have. Robin DiAngelo. You give me the reading list, General Milley, and I'll give you a reading list. And then we'll expose the cadets to the entire reading list. What do you think about that? Since cadets should be well-read and senior military should be well-read, I certainly agree. I think everyone should be well-read. But I'm sorry, General Milley, it's you and your political hacks in uniforms who are doing the work of leftist ideologues and the anti-racist crowd, meaning the racist crowd, who says this is part of their rap. We don't address criticism because the criticism is rooted in systemic racism. And so to address it is to legitimize it and then marginalize our position. So we will not marginalize our position by addressing any counterarguments. Does that sound like robust theory, General? He is offensive. That answer is offensive and ignorant, and it should rile every American because he is the fracking chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Holy cow. This is not some, you know, goofy fifth grade teacher in some suburban school district.
No, he's America's top general.
I mean, for goodness sakes, and then tell me again, this is a little bit theory that's batted around in law schools. This is nothing to pay attention to. Don't worry about it, says Barack Obama and Professor Kimberly Crenshaw and the rest of these leftist intellects who don't want to defend what they're perpetrating and promulgating on the merits. General Milley, it offends me. Yeah. he should have. I wish there was. I mean, Walt did a fine job, but I wish somebody would have come right back down his throat. Go frack yourself, General Milley. I'm not going to sit here and listen to you pontificate nonsense and denigrate your uniform and the United States military in the process.
And that everyone, and everyone who fought for this country in war uniform.
That should be the response. And by the way, veterans, because, you know, I'm just a candy ass from Wheaton. But those who served in uniform, they should be outraged by what they heard from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They should be, I hope this gets kicked around in Legion halls and VFWs around the country. I hope at VAs people are talking about it and leveling up their disgust with this sort of propagandizing by General Milley. I mean, it's really terrible. And it confirms exactly what Carafano, Lieutenant Colonel Carafano, mm-hmm. said on this show. Weak. Weak intellectually. And if you're weak intellectually, then you're a weak leader, General Milley. Mm-hmm. Joe in Tinley Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, if that general would have admitted he read Huckleberry Finn, he'd be up for discharge today.
Yeah, right. Thanks, Joe. Gary in Milwaukee.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good. Son, you sound like you're pretty worked up about this issue. I'm a 20-year war fighter, and I'm listening to all of this. And critical race theory, I think, is needed. I think we need to talk about the history of this country. You know, what gets me is I have conversations with people, and you know what I was taught. You know what I was taught in elementary school. That Christopher Columbus discovered America. That George Washington never lied and cut down a cherry tree. Indoctrination, right? That was an indoctrination of the white race.
Mm-hmm.
Superiority. You know, that Native Americans were savages. I remember watching John Wayne on television slaughtering savages and me cheering for that. It was an indoctrination. What critical race theory does is reversing that. I don't think it's teaching anybody to hate anybody, but it pulls the cover back.
The seminar on understanding whiteness and white rage.
Really, really. Hey, Gary, hold on a second. Hold on, because I want to let you finish your thought and then I want to respond. But I want you to hear something first and tell, because critical race theory, as it is being taught in schools and in corporate retreats, you know, these critical race theorists who are signed on as diversity consultants and brought in to do seminars and so forth. Listen to Ashley Shackelford, okay? Let's just listen to this. It's just a few seconds. Listen to what she has to say as she's addressing mainly a crowd of white people, mainly middle-aged white women. Listen to her, and then we'll get back to you.
White people are racist. So I put this up because I really want any white person in the room to know up front that this is what we're dealing with, that it's not going to be this coddling of white tears and what that looks like. We're not going to discuss, oh, maybe some of us have worked it out. No, you're always going to be racist, actually. So even when you're on your path to trying to figure out how to be a better human being, because I believe that white people are born into not being human, like that actually, instead of people of color and black folks being dehumanized, that actually everyone is dehumanized off rip within white supremacy, that y'all are born into a life to not be human, and that's what y'all are taught to do, to be demons. So in this particular way, white people are all racist.
It's probably making six figures.
That needs to be that needs to be pushed back on. You know what? I marched with my dad. I'm 62 years old. I walked with my dad here in Milwaukee across the 6th Street Viaduct Bridge in protest because African Americans could not get fair wage jobs and all the other discriminatory. And you know what? There were more white people out marching with us. So that type of theory needs to be pushed back on. We need to tell the truth.
Okay.
That's what needs to happen. We need to have an honest discussion. All white people are not racist. There are white people that gave their lives for the uplifting of black people. But I also say this. This country really needs to do an examination of itself. And this is what I say. If a country can create laws to discriminate against one race of people, that country also has the responsibility to create laws to uplift that race of people that was discriminated against, disenfranchised against. And just because you get rid of a law, that does not fix the problem.
Oh, I agree with that.
This country has a lot of things that we need to. And so all of this, I listen to all I do is listen to conservative radio. I voted Republican. I voted Democratic. I consider myself to be a left-leaning independent. And I listen to, all I do is listen to conservative radio because I'm looking for common ground, things right. that I can agree on.
Well,
and it's getting more and more difficult for me to do that.
Well, let's see if we can have forged this common ground, because I agree with some of what you said. But the critical race, teaching our country's history, that's fine. Hashing out the history, whether it's been mischaracterized to the benefit of some historical figures who are white or some historical figures who are black, don't care. Hash it out. Fine. Bring to the table whatever scholarship you want. Read whatever you want, and let's have a broad discussion on it. I mean, the curriculum in a school is a jumping off point. It is not it's not supposed to be exhaustive in any particular class. However, with critical race theory, the indictment, the thing that makes it untenable intellectually. You read it if you want. Bring your Ibram Kendi to class. Don't care. Fine. The thing that makes it untenable is it seeks silence. To borrow from Justice Robert Jackson in West Virginia v. Barnett, compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. And that's what critical race theory seeks to achieve. Compulsory unification of opinion, because it does not countenance any disagreement, any questioning. Any questions are rooted in white supremacy, part of our racist DNA, this your subconscious racism, and so on and so forth. It's sophistry, and to be embraced not just as something to consider, but as exclusive, to the extent that we can't talk about Shelby Steele's white guilt, because that's going to offend the critical race theorists that are in charge of most classrooms, and apparently the military as well. That's the problem with critical race theory. So you want to talk about America's history. You want to introduce people to authors, scholars they maybe not have not heard of. That's fine. But anybody who is uninterested in defending their position or is offended by even the suggestion that they should be questioned or have to defend their position is a charlatan and should be called as such. And that's my problem with what Millie had to say and with these critical race theory race hustlers generally.
Yeah. Okay. I hear you, but I will close by saying this. So I am an elementary principal in the city of Milwaukee. My school is 99.9% economically disadvantaged. And I watch a lot of conservative talk shows and stuff, and they're talking about how the governor of Georgia said there's no of Texas, saying there's no critical race theory being taught there in Texas. But people are up in arms, but a philosophy like that should not be taught. I mean, if a university wants to do that and they've got people paying to go there, and if that's what they want to teach, then I don't know. But I don't think that should be taught at the public school level or any level like that. I don't think it should be taught. Well, you know, universities, they have the free will to do what they want to do, but I would push back on a lot of that stuff.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Gary, thanks so much for calling.
There's some common ground. All right. Thanks for the call, Gary, and for serving our country and for being a school principal.
Good for him. I bet he's excellent at his job.
Lee and Hammond.
Yeah, hi, guys. You know, in regard to that last caller, critical race theory teaches that whole people, because of their birth or their of them with the color of their skin, are inherently racist, is by definition racist. You know, if we're going to follow that kind of mantra, aren't we going to start saying the same kind of defects about people with black skin, yellow skin, red skin, brown skin? I mean, that's all. This is, by definition, this is racist. This is a Marxist wedge issue that's meant to take this country apart. And the fact that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is actually condoning this to be taught to the military, it's sort of equivalent to, like, in 1938 or 39, teaching Nazism to our troops. I mean, I don't understand why people can't understand these things.
All right, thanks for the call, Lee. Grant in Rockford.
Good morning, you guys. I got to respond to that guy real quick. There's a difference between talking to full-grown cadets. Now, I find critical race theory absolutely despicable and disgusting. But at least those are adults who can make up their own mind. My problem is when they tell it to elementary and preschool. Those kids, they look up to these teachers, and I don't know why. I don't know teachers anyway.
It's just disgusting. And I'm offended at that general's offense at my original comment, and it's good to know that when the split happens, mealy-mouthed wussies like him will be in charge, and they will get taken down right away. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call, Grant. I go back to Ilana Redstone, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Illinois, because critical race theory, which is just a term that was coined a couple decades ago by Kimberly Crenshaw at Columbia Law School, this is just an outgrowth of conflict theory. I mean, this is not new, really, except its application to race and its intolerance of dissent, as so articulated by Ibram Kendi in How to Be an Anti-Racist. But Ilana Redstone had this great talk, this great piece in Tablet that we talked about on this show about conflict theory. And this is a really elegant way to understand it. Conflict theory, and by extension, critical race theory and intersectional theory, looks into the room of social problems and shines a giant spotlight on a single aspect of the human condition, yet leaves the rest of the room dark. That's the indictment of conflict theory and critical race and intersectional theory. One aspect shines a bright light on, that's all we should talk about, that's all we should focus on, and the rest of the room is dark. So how is that seeing everything for what it is? It's not. It's distorting what is there because you only see a sliver of it. That's what I'm talking about. And that's what General Milley doesn't seem to understand.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Not a doctor. Jill Biden was in Tennessee flacking for vaccinations.
Yeah, with Brad Paisley.
Only 3 in 10 Tennesseans are vaccinated. And, well, you're booing yourselves.
I guess you don't. Oh, my God. Is that funny?
Okay. Yeah, well, the big news yesterday is that the CDC panel, which was supposed to meet last week, but they didn't because of Juneteenth. They said there is a likely association between the vaccine and the inflammation of the heart. But they still say, Dan, the benefits of being vaccinated far outweigh the risk.
Yeah, well, they are not providing nuance in the discussion, it would seem, and that makes what they are saying a problem. Professor Francois Ballot, who is at the Genetics Institute, University College London, had an interesting tweet thread on the topic, specifically with child vaccination, since that's effectively where we are. He writes, child COVID-19 vaccination feels like the mother of all ethical minefields. I expected those discussions wouldn't be easy, but the non-trivial rate of myocarditis in teenage boys following mRNA vaccines makes the situation worse than I anticipated. I worry that once most at risk will have that once those most at risk will have been vaccinated, the bitter discussions about the ethics of herd immunity strategies may be back on the table. I don't dare envision how toxic the discussion about vaccinating children for COVID-19 could be. And he goes on to suggest, based on data calculations, it's now clear that the mRNA vaccines can cause myocarditis in children and young adults. The side effect is most common in teenage boys with a rate 5/1,000 of a percent, but that has to be balanced. And that's what he says, and what we've said for lo these many months. This has to be balanced against the risk associated with COVID-19 infection. It's not easy, but for example, the study that he references here reported a risk of hospitalization peaking at about 2/1,000 of a percent, but with 70% of hospitalized teenagers having pre-existing conditions, just as the small fraction of those under the age of 18 who have died from COVID. Some 300 have died over the last year. At the same time, 45,000 people under the age of 18 have died from all causes, just to give you some proportionality. But the risk of the vaccine for young people versus the risk of COVID for young people, that's what the conversation should be, rather than just mindless get vaccinated. Everybody from in utero to the oldest person in the world get vaccinated.
Well, now Dr. Fauci's in. He's like, the only way to eradicate this is everyone gets vaccinated.
Yeah, well, he's got some problems, including perhaps from an unlikely source. George Gresham, who's the president of SEIU, United Healthcare Workers East, the largest healthcare union, largest healthcare union in the country, said hospital systems don't have the right to mandate vaccines for employees. Well, tell that to Houston Methodist.
Yeah, 123 people are out of a job.
But now you have the unions, public sector, well, not just public sector, private sector here with respect to healthcare workers at healthcare systems, hospital systems, saying, no, we're going to fight that.
Well, CTU's fighting that because CPS wants mandatory vaccinations for the teachers, and they said we're not doing that. But yet the CTU wants us, our kids to be all vaccinated.
So the pitched battle persists. For more on the topic, pleased to be joined by Dr. Robert Malone. He is a specialist in clinical research, medical affairs, regulatory affairs, project management, and proposal management. Vaccines and biodefense. He's the discoverer of in vitro and in vivo RNA transfection and the inventor of mRNA and DNA vaccines. And we'll have to have him explain most of what I just read. Dr. Malone, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Sure. And I wanted, if allow me just to do a shout out. I'm a graduate of Northwestern University Medical School.
Yeah.
And my wife used to work for the Brookfield Zoo, so I'm very glad to speak to Chicagoland.
Well, I'm a graduate of Northwestern undergrad, and I don't, I usually issue an apology after I say that. But Northwestern Medical School, that's a little bit more serious. So we'll respect that. Probably just under working for the Brookfield Zoo in terms of status. I saw this, speaking of tweet strings, I saw this that you posted on Twitter, and I thought it was a provocative question, then understood your background, it became that much more provocative. You tweeted out, what happens to confidence in public health if ivermectin turns out to be safe and effective for COVID and the genetic vaccines turn out to have significant safety issues? Yeah, what happens, particularly if in the case of children?
And you saw that one went viral with a lot of commentary. People are very engaged on that question. What I kind of intentionally didn't say was the third leg on that stool, which is the lab leak issue. And that one is getting curiouser and curiouser.
Well, right. But speak to the vaccines and the discussion now, including with that University College London professor's comments about vaccinations for children under the age of 18 or now even under the age of 12, which is sort of where we're at.
Before we go there, can I comment on the Tony Fauci statement?
Sure.
The problem with Tony's comments about herd immunity with these vaccines is that all the endpoints that we focused on are disease endpoints. These vaccines, the 90% efficacy is about protection from hospitalization and death. It's not about protection from viral spread. These vaccines are not sterilizing. You still get infected. Many people still get infected. They still shed virus. They can still transmit virus. Calculations about herd immunity require an agent or a strategy that will be able to block virus transmission, not disease caused by virus. Okay? And so, Tony, I have an objection to all this chatter about generating herd immunity based on X percent of uptake of vaccines, whatever it is. 70 is one that's often cited. That's not data-based. Okay, those arguments, anybody, frankly, I've said this in another tweet, anybody that's asserting that they know that we can get to herd immunity based on these vaccines if a certain percent of the population takes them doesn't know what they're talking about. Well, this is fundamental.
Right. But I mean, Dr. Fauci was saying we're going to eradicate COVID if we all get vaccinated now. And if we don't, there might be more lockdowns in the winter.
It's okay. So what we call that is coercion.
Okay.
He's making a threat. If you don't do this population, remember he's cloaked himself and said basically he is science. Mm-hmm. And if we disagree with him, we're anti-science. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I am all about science, but I strongly disagree with Tony. Tony is substituting often his opinion for facts and for data. And we have to get back to data-based decision-making, to science-based medicine. Okay, so these statements about eradicating COVID, in my opinion, there's no way that we are going to eradicate COVID from the SARS-CoV-2 virus and its variants from the human population. If we could have eradicated polio, we would have. So these statements are gross oversimplifications of the complexities that we have. But that wasn't really what you wanted to talk about. You wanted to talk about childhood vaccination. And I strongly agree with the WHO in their switch in position that at this point in time, childhood vaccination is not recommended. But I object on an even deeper level. I kind of been out front with some arguments about the bioethics. And here's the thing. These are experimental vaccines, full stop. Okay? You can't deny that these are experimental. They have not yet been approved. Therefore, they fall under a whole cascade of consensus in the West, at least, about bioethics of medical research. This goes back to the Nuremberg Code. It goes to the Helsinki Accords. It goes to the Belmont Report. And oh, by the way, it's codified in federal law. We call it the Common Rule. Common Rule has three key elements. First off, there has to be full and open disclosure of risks to anybody that is going to take an experimental product. And by the way, only adults are able to give consent. That's why we call it the age of consent. Okay, so there has to be full and open disclosure of risks all the way down into the weeds, just like you see in a package insert. Number two, those risks can't be hidden with fancy medical terminology. They have to be stated in a way that average people of eighth grade education can understand them. Okay, so simple language, people have to comprehend it. Number three, the encoded in the federal law is that for experimental products, people have to willingly accept the participation in what is essentially a medical experiment. They have to willingly accept it based on their understanding of risks. This is bedrock bioethics. We cannot coerce people. That means pressure them through social media, through government announcements, through, you know, denying potential risks, through gaslighting them, through censoring and not allowing discussion. I mean, we've crossed some lines here, and some countries are down in the weeds of, I can't believe that I'm saying this, offering ice cream to children so that they can get jabs without their parents' approval.
Well,
wrong. Wrong.
I want it because it, to me, is that any different? I mean, it's the same thing. We've talked about this, but this has not been criticized. Concert tickets. Booze for young for young adults and potentially
shotgun lotteries in West Virginia. I mean, it's all the same thing. This is not okay.
You find this all unethical?
It is grossly unethical. Yeah. It's a violation of federal law.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so 26 million kids, 18 and younger, were given doses of Pfizer, and 323 cases of heart inflammation. That's such an infinitesimal number. I mean, would that have happened anyway, regardless if they had the vaccine?
Okay, I'd like to talk about the incidents. No, yes, the answer is no. So I'm concerned. I don't work for CDC. I don't currently work with CDC. But those data are based on the VSAFE and the VAERS databases, which are voluntary reporting. They are grossly... Those databases grossly underreport events, adverse events. So I'm not clear how the CDC can calculate a ratio by taking the known total number of doses as the denominator and the reported number of cases of cardiac inflammation as the numerator, as the upper number in the ratio.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have data on the total incidence of any of these adverse events. And so, again, my opinion, personal opinion, is the government is not being fully transparent in disclosing risks, and they are obligated to do so. And this ratio is, I know they don't have the data to say what they're saying. I'm very uncomfortable with this. Furthermore, there are some fundamental, this is down in the weeds, of biostatistics. but the two key words are confounding variables and masking. The reason, I believe, why these signals are apparent in the adolescent population is because they have essentially no background level of this type of disease. They, you know, adolescents don't get heart attacks, right?
Right.
They don't get cardiac things except very, very, very rarely.
Right.
As opposed to, as you get into older cohorts, it's fairly common. The problem is that the signal from those fairly common events that normally happen in older adults make it really hard to see the signal that might be related to vaccine. And it also makes it really easy for people that are making decisions about whether or not something is related or unrelated to vaccination to say, oh, it's just a cardiac event and this is an older male.
Right.
Therefore, it's not related.
Well, you know, and
so
there are
intrinsic problems with this analysis, and I am not comfortable that we've got to the bottom of this yet.
Well, and to your point, neither is Harvey Risch, epidemiologist at Yale, and Joe Lodapo, who's at UCLA's Geffen School of Medicine, their op-ed suggesting the same thing. They took some of the VAERS information and issued all of the caveats you just issued, and then say, but here we still see arcs in these sort of four categories of adverse outcomes that require further study before anybody
There's another one that they missed that the FDA is also aware of, but it's not yet officially disclosed, which is reactivation of latent viruses like shingles.
Hmm. Okay. Okay.
And I agree with the assessment in that editorial. I was very grateful. I mean, I've been out. For me, this is a huge professional risk. I'm a consultant. I work closely with the government, but I felt like I needed to speak up about the bioethics and some of the fundamentals here. And as you know, it was the Brett Weinstein podcast, and my comments and editorials on Trial Site News that kind of drove me into the public sphere. I generally don't seek, I'm not somebody who seeks media attention. It's not good for my business. And all of this is not good for my business. I'm not doing this to make money. Matter of fact, it's hurting my business. But I think it's important to say it. And I completely concur with the two gentlemen. And I was very grateful to see that published in the Wall Street Journal.
Well, we appreciate you coming forward as well. We need people to provide leadership based on their expertise. And you're doing that. He is Dr. Robert Malone, who is the discoverer of in vitro and in vivo RNA transfection, the inventor of mRNA and DNA vaccines, and a specialist in clinical research in a number of other areas. Dr. Malone, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for the opportunity, and hello, Chicagoland. Thanks.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. If we've learned one thing over the last year from the pandemic and all of the discussions around all of the various aspects of the COVID response, it should have been that the science has never really settled. We're always trying to understand something we don't completely understand.
And science evolves over time.
And so that should be also applied to the topic of climate science, one would think, and yet still we have politicians speak with moral certainty, much more moral certainty than perhaps evidence. And the science is settled, and if you ask questions, forget disagree, if you ask questions about the evidentiary basis, you're a denier. Just like if you ask questions about vaccinations or mask wearing, you're a COVID denier. Can't ask questions because once a certain critical mass of leftist public health officials or policymakers or academics or the combination of all three categories says it's settled, then it's over and the discussion has now been completed. Well, that's not the case with infectious disease, and it's not the case with climate either. And our next guest, Stephen Koonin, made quite a splash when he came out and suggested as much, that it's not settled, that the models, that the climate is something that's very difficult to model, and he'll explain why, because he was the former chief scientist for the Department of Energy under one President Obama, and you're supposed to hew to the orthodoxy when it comes to the apocalyptic pronouncements of politicians like, well, the climate czar du jour. It happens to be John Kerry now. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Stephen Koonin, university professor at NYU, with appointments in the Stern School of Business, the Tandon School of Engineering, and the Department of Physics. He founded NYU's Center for Urban Science and Progress and served as Undersecretary for Science in the U.S. Department of Energy under President Obama from 2009 to 2011. His new book, Unsettled, Why What Climate Science Tells Us, What It Doesn't, and Why It Matters. Professor Koonin, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be talking with you both this morning.
So climate modeling is central to climate science. That's something that you said. And I wonder if you still believe that with what you're suggesting is the difficulty in modeling climate science for much prospective value for current policymaking.
Well, climate modeling is essential to trying to understand how the climate will change in the future and why it's changed in the past. But it's also a very, very difficult task. And most of the public discussion is simply, this is what the model says. When in fact, there are many different models that say many different things about how the climate might respond. And so it needs to be represented realistically. It's important, but it's also quite uncertain.
Yeah, Kerry Emanuel at MIT explained it this way. Computer modeling of global climate is perhaps the most complex endeavor ever undertaken by humankind. A typical climate model consists of millions of lines of computer instructions designed to simulate an enormous range of physical phenomena. The problem here is that there are many important processes that happen at much smaller scales than are easily modeled. And that's fine if it was presented like that. But as you essentially suggest, it's not presented like that. It's presented like there's a model that somebody made. It predicts this by 2100. The science is settled. And now let's get to the carbon taxes.
Yeah. You know, I mean, Kerry is a fine scientist. He and I disagree about some things. But the public is not getting an accurate perception of what we know and what we don't know. And I wrote the book Unsettled in order to better inform the public, not to persuade them.
Well, the public, you know, now there's a huge drought in the West Coast, places like Utah, Arizona, and they're banging the drum that this is climate change.
Well, you know, that would be fine. Well, it depends what you mean by climate change. If it's natural climate change, that's one thing. If it's human-induced climate change, that's quite another. And what you have to understand about the droughts in the West is that we have seen many episodes of drought over the past 2,000 years. We understand them from tree rings and river flows and so on that we have proxy records of. And so you've got to explain why this particular drought is human-caused as opposed to the many other droughts of comparable size that happened well before humans were influencing the climate.
Well, I mean, that sort of nuance is lost in the discussion, which I know is part of your argument. And everything that happens, every natural disaster, every weather event is presented by the media and some politicians as evidence of climate change with no distinction like you just made, and thus the need to, you know, ban fossil fuels and set up windmills and all the other policies that you're familiar with in terms of the advocacy. And so how frustrating is it for you? Wildfires in California, a hurricane in Florida, all climate change, all supporting evidence for the policies of, you know, banning fossil fuels and the other suggestions I made.
It is very frustrating. I mean, the data are out there in the official records and in the research reports. And when you try to point people to them and explain to them that climate is not the weather this year or even the last few years, but is a multi-decade average of the weather. People just don't want to listen. It's a kind of fingers in the ears, eyes shut attitude, which I think is very detrimental to trying to make rational decisions about energy and climate.
98% of scientists agree that climate change poses an existential threat to the future of the planet. The science is settled. Is that true?
No, that's not true at all. That's flat out wrong. The 97 or 98% number, which was done, which arises from a flawed survey that was thoroughly debunked some years ago, and no scientist I know, except if they're in the political sphere, uses the phrase existential threat or climate disaster or climate crisis. That's just not supported by the science. And, you know, when I hear politicians talking with those words, I'm reminded of the line from The Princess Bride, where one of the characters keeps using the word inconceivable. And then Inigo Montoya says, "You keep using that word. I don't think it means what you think it means."
That's a great
science does not say what the politicians say.
That is a fantastic Mandy Patinkin impersonation you do. I'm very impressed. That's very good.
So do you feel like you're on an island all your own when it comes to climate change?
No. Well, you know, out in the public, I wouldn't say that I'm an island all my own, maybe a peninsula. But, you know, when you talk to many knowledgeable scientists in private, they will acknowledge all of this. But when it comes to the public face, represented by a few scientists and many institutions, it's a monolithic disaster is coming.
Why? Why is that the case? Why will they only tell the truth in hushed tones?
You know, there's professional opprobrium that, I mean, I've seen it myself as I've started to speak out.
Yeah.
There's grant money involved. And, you know, scientists get invested in their theories and what they've said, and it takes a long time for many people to calm down.
There was a press release out of University of Colorado Boulder just this week, or maybe it was last week, earlier this month. Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at CU Boulder, Jennifer Kay. "Our work shows the increase in climate sensitivity from the last generation of climate models should be taken with a huge grain of salt." The title of the release, "Warmer Clouds, Cooler Planet," and that criticism of the last generation of climate models that she offers.
Yeah, so there are multiple generations of climate models. The next one, which informs the UN report that will be released in August, you know, they get more and more sophisticated, but they get more and more discrepant with one another and with the data. And about 40% of the new generation of models show a very high sensitivity to greenhouse gases, but they also do a lousy job of describing the temperature history over the last 50 years. And of the paleoclimate data, they do a bad job of describing that as well. So as we started our conversation, the models are important, but they're very tricky.
And what of the pronouncements that are made by these international bodies like the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that is, you know, oft cited again by politicians, you know, the appeal to authority fallacy? As you know, this is the gospel of the leading atmospheric scientists and physicists and climatologists of the world, and this is the basis on which we should be making public policy.
Yeah. So the politicians are not scientists.
Yes.
And so they're at the end of this long game of telephone that starts with the data and the research papers. It goes through the assessment reports written by the UN and governments. It goes through the summaries of those assessment reports, which have the heavy hand of government when they're written, and then finally to the media. And so, you know, you've got to get back to the beginning of that chain. And I wrote the book Unsettled in order to try to tell people what's actually in the reports, as opposed to what gets filtered by all these different layers.
And so what are the big questions that we should be exploring and that even laymen like us on this show and people who listen should be asking policymakers before they sign on to support a particular policy?
Yeah, I think it starts with trying to get an honest picture for non-experts. And that means, in my mind, an adversarial process in which one group writes the report and another group is charged with looking at what's wrong with this report. And that kind of process is routinely used in high-consequence decisions. It has not been used for the climate assessments. So I would start first with that. Secondly, as you read the media, any article that uses the word denier quotes the 97%, doesn't give you numbers with uncertainties, doesn't provide historical context. These are all the things to look for in a media report that are red flags and say, hey, wait a second, somebody's trying to persuade me, not inform me.
That's straightforward, and that sounds perfectly sensible to me. He is Stephen Koonin, university professor at NYU. He also founded NYU's Center for Urban Science and Progress, served as Undersecretary for Science in the U.S. Department of Energy under President Obama from 2009 to 2011. The book, pick it up, Unsettled, What Climate Science Tells Us, What It Doesn't, and Why It Matters. Professor Koonin, also a very good, very big Princess Bride fan,
yes,
and a Mandy Patinkin impersonator.
Yes.
Yeah. Professor Koonin, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Good luck with the book.
Okay. Wonderful to chat with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. This coming Friday night, which I guess just tomorrow night, we track of the days.
Today's Thursday, which means tomorrow's Friday, Dan.
We got a new sheriff in town. Sheriff David Clark is coming to town for the Will County GOP Freedom Day dinner.
Yes, and it's sponsored by the Will County Republican Central Committee. For tickets, which start at $100, visit freedomdaydinner.com, freedomdaydinner.com. It is tomorrow night, Friday, at 7 p.m., at the Renaissance Center in Joliet. Again, Sheriff David Clark, Mike Burke, gubernatorial candidates Gary Rabine, and State Senator Darren Bailey will be there, among others.
For more on this and a little talk about Republican Party politics in Illinois, please be joined by George Pearson, who is a political analyst for WGN-TV and chairman of the Will County GOP. George, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. How are you two?
Good morning. Freedom Day dinner. What happened to Lincoln Day dinner? Are you canceling Abraham Lincoln, George Pearson?
Absolutely not. Well, because of the pandemic, it had everyone on a lockdown still and didn't want to take a chance on any of our businesses in Will County losing their license over our dictatorial governor. We decided to move it to June, which, you know, again, because it's been recognized as freedom for a lot of different things, from Juneteenth celebration to opening up spring and, you know, President Trump's birthday. So we figured Freedom Day dinner would be a nice little ring in the month of June.
Now, are Gary Rabine and Darren Bailey going to have a debate, or is it going to be cordial?
That's a great question. You know, we're creating a forum so that all the gubernatorial candidates will have an opportunity, Paul Shen, Max Solomon, Darren Bailey, and Gary Rabine, to be on the stage to answer the questions and, if necessary, challenge one another. I love competition, and I believe that's one of the things that are missing in our party. We tend to pick one side, and that's who we run with, and that has gotten us in trouble over the last 20 years. And I can name a couple of politicians right here in Illinois on the Republican side that have, you know, caused a lot of this.
Yeah.
So what we want, is open debate. We want a dialogue between them and the voters. This is about the voters. We're bringing in Sheriff David Clark and John Contazera, president of FOP Lodge number 7. We've got Illinois Supreme Court Justice Mike Burke to talk about, you know, some of the things that are coming up with the mapping and some of the legislation. We want a very robust debate for all our voters so that they're well-informed and pull a Republican ballot this June 28, 2022.
Well, as I said in previewing our talk, you're one of the bright spots in terms of local leaders in the Republican Party. Now, that said, that's a low bar, but nonetheless, one of the bright spots. Yeah, he is, and you're willing to call out bad actors in the party, which has been something that's been sorely needed for a couple of generations. I wonder how you think the Illinois Republican Party and the various Republican office holders, the few that are left, performed during the pandemic.
They didn't perform well. They didn't perform well because there were a lot of different factors in there. A lot of people did not know what was going on. And I believe that's all of our fault, because we've allowed our governments on both the federal and the state level to become so large that we depend on them to make our decisions for us on a daily basis. We have to start becoming more educated. Therefore, we don't rely on the politicals to make decisions. They work from the little bit of information that they were being spoon-fed. If we honestly start electing people that will be represented by the people and representing the voices of the people, then you'll find we'll have more open dialogue and get to the truth, which we saw happening with President Trump.
And so, what do you expect going forward? It seems to me that Pritzker has had the run of the field and the run of the suburbs, as Democrats have continued to really take over suburban Chicagoland, including Will County. I mean, Will County Board.
Yeah.
What needs to happen for the Republican Party to be relevant, if not competitive, in the suburbs and by extension statewide? Do we have to talk about what K-12 education should look like? Are we going to talk about the lessons from the pandemic? I hear Darren Bailey talking about it a little bit, but I don't hear much from any Republicans.
No, I completely agree, 100%. Where there are all different types of groups that are spawning up all over the place, Dan and Amy, you've got an organization called YANA, You Are Not Alone. And a lot of these folks are moms, school soccer moms and dads. So they're finally deciding, you know what, our silence has been part of the problem here. They're not showing up to the school board meetings. They're not showing up to their county board or their village board meetings. Again, if you want to see the change, we have to stop looking to the people that have been sitting in these spots for so long. We have to start looking at ourselves. Michael Jackson's song, The Man in the Mirror, it starts with you. We need election judges.
Can you
do a couple of bars from that for us?
Yeah.
You say you got
no.
No. I don't think you got the upper register that he had.
No, not at all.
All right.
We need election judges. If I can.
Go ahead.
This point is very important. If in fact you want to make sure that you have ballot integrity, election integrity, we need election judges. Don't get me wrong. Poll watchers are important. They're secondary. We need election judges. So people out there that are listening, don't be afraid to ask for a Republican ballot in June 28th, 2022. And don't be afraid to work as a election judge.
Well, how is that going to
help? We need you at these locations.
Okay.
Because election judges touch the ballots. We saw all throughout the challenge.
Sometimes they fill them out.
Yeah. In Chicago, probably. But that's why we need our Republicans sitting at the table, too, looking at those ballots. So if they're missing the signature, they're missing the date, the signatures don't match, the address is no longer a valid address, we should be rejecting those ballots. But time and time again, we've seen over and over again, hell, right here in Will County, we rejected over 2,000 ballots in the last election cycle. So, how do we change this? It starts with each and every single one of us doing our part. This is a citizen participation. When you sit back and you allow the politicals and the elites to do it, this is what the government should get.
I can't help but think about those Trump rallies last year. I'm talking about the ones actually in Illinois that were organized by Tom Meredith, who's not a political guy. And it wasn't run through Republican Party organizations. It wasn't didn't have Republican state legislators. And I mean, he was putting 5,000 and 10,000 people on fairgrounds fields around the metropolitan area. These are people that are clearly not participating in Republican Party politics in this state, in this area. And of course, this goes completely unreflected upon by most of whatever passes for the Republican Party And it just seems to me that, like, I don't know, when 5 or 10,000 people supporting a Republican president show up to rally for him in absentia, maybe that is a market opportunity. Or is that me?
For you to actually be there and be engaged. Absolutely. But you know where we also failed? We didn't turn around and re-engage with those folks, those 5,000. We had 750 people show up to one of our rallies. We messed up. We didn't get everybody's name and contact information so that we can say we need to fill those spots.
Yeah. Well, but it also speaks to, like, why are those people coming out? What is it that is so attractive to them? Maybe that is something that should be considered. Gosh, what are we not doing to generate that sort of enthusiasm, right?
Yeah. We're open, plain talk dialogue. We're not, well, I know we're on Salem radio station, so I have to watch my language.
Yeah,
as well.
Exactly. Keep
it clean. We're not tiptoeing. Yeah, we're not tiptoeing around the issues. I don't do it down in Will County. I believe it's one of the reasons why we're starting to see a turnaround here. Look, Will County was divided up into 6 congressional districts, 20 different state Senate districts. It has been a shambles. And the Democrats had control of the last 2 maps. And that's a problem when you're trying to get people engaged. And most folks out here, they're almost too afraid to pull a Republican ballot because they don't want to be shamed. So we actually have to buck up. You got to have the same courage that Donald Trump was out there showing.
Yeah.
You have to have the same courage that we see from Ron DeSantis and Governor Abbott down in Texas. We have to see that type of courage bubbling up from each and every single one of our elected officials in order to continue to inspire those to get up off their duffs and go out there and work the polls, knock doors, make phone calls, heck, make a contribution. If you're tired of your politicians being ruled by D.C. or Springfield, then open up your wallet and contribute to those candidates. Therefore, you have a say in what's going on. And if they don't, then you fund their competition in the primary.
Right.
That's where we have been failing.
Yeah, I'll make a contribution if somebody makes an argument. You know, I mean, we're seeing, in addition to COVID-19, where most of the GOP here were church mice, critical race theory in the schools, that intellectual poison. And you're seeing revolts in Loudoun County, Virginia, in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, all over the country. And obviously Republican governors taking some action, too. And yet here, I mean, you had that one father down in Decatur who gave the school board chapter and verse, which was great. But you don't see it up here. I mean, you see it from like 9-year-old children. You see the children are courageous enough to stick their necks out. And probably their parents are, too, which is why the children.
Yes.
Do.
And we don't hear from that. That Naperville, Plainfield, that area,
where
New Lenox. Oh, you ought to see these parents out here in New Lenox and Frankfurt that are pushing back on CRT, pushing back on this nonsense, pushing back on HB 3653, this law enforcement bill, which inspired this Freedom Day dinner. You know, they're there. We're having these conversations. We just don't always get the right coverage for it. So when you say that, you know, they're not involved with a lot of the Republican organizations, you're absolutely right. And again, that's a failure on our part, but we're changing that. We're reaching out to folks. We're saying groups like YANA, we get it. You don't want the title of the Republican just yet, but everything you're fighting for right now, you don't want your children masked this coming school cycle. You don't want your children to be forced to take a vaccination. That's, you know, well, I think is one of the biggest trial, you know, that has ever occurred in the medical history, you know, with the shots that are out there, pick your poison on the branding of it. You have to show up. You can no longer sit at home. And we saw that in New Lenox. We saw it in Frankfort, Plainfield, Newton, Naperville. These children are being inspired that might be coming up, but you damn sure better believe there's a parent behind them teaching them.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, look, I hate to play this game, but this is the reality. And it's important to have leadership from black men like you in the Republican Party. I mean, we've had this conversation with Bob Woodson and Shelby Steele and others, too. It's like we need black conservative leadership within conservative leadership to really lead some of these fights, whether it comes to K-12 curriculum or COVID or economic opportunity or any policy area. All policy areas need that sort of leadership because it's sort of jujitsuing so many of these, you know, PC-addled identitarians in the suburbs who want to come after you and just be able to call you a name and walk away. It's much more difficult to do that with when they're doing it to George Pearson.
Yeah, you know, George Pearson has been a target for a lot of this for a long time. I don't care. I'm used to getting shot at. We have a lot of these brothers out there, A.J. White, Fred Bannion in Chicago. I mean, there's so many of them, Chuck. Devin Jones. They're are out there. They are there. We are out here with the fight. It's just it's becoming difficult to get, again, the right coverage that, you know, let folks know. I mean, right here in Chicago, in Cook County, you saw an increase in black males voting for President Trump.
Right.
Why?
Yeah.
Because they finally saw some stones coming out of the party.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you want actually more black men, because we are pretty strong by nature, then we also have to see some strength coming from those that are sitting in leadership as well.
Well, that is a challenge that persists. There's no question. He is George Pearson. He is a political analyst for WGN-TV. He's also the chairman of the Will County GOP. And Amy, those deets on tomorrow night's dinner?
Again, to get tickets, because there are seats available, go to freedomdaydinner.com, freedomdaydinner.com.
George Pearson, thanks as always for joining us. Good luck with the dinner tomorrow. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. And a big shout out to our sponsors, Richard Uline, Mayor Roger Clare, and Robert Cruz.
All right.
Very good.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.